Single Thread Theater presents PXR 2026, a mix of live performances, interactive digital presentations, technical deep dives, and exciting installations right here in Kingston at Modern Fuel, the Tet, and at Fort Henry. Get whisked away into immersive worlds like snowy cities, cyberpunk dystopias, musical mushrooms, and coastal shores. The conference runs February 20th through March 1st. Learn more by following Single Thread Theater on Instagram and get your tickets now via performanceandxr.com. See you there.
Welcome. And good afternoon. It's 4 o'clock. Thanks for tuning in to CFRC 101.9 FM. We are located here in Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name is Bruce, and this is Finding a Voice, a spoken word program airing here every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 o'clock. We do stream live online as well at www.cfrc.ca. And coming up on the show today, in the first and then well into the second hour, you're going to hear an unaired event from a September 19th, 2025 Kingston Writers Fest event called Bushwhacked by Inspiration Short Stories. You'll hear a conversation between moderator Serge Chiang and authors Catherine Bush, Deepa Rajagopalan, my fault, and Jamal Saeed. Also, including you'll hear in it a reading by Sarah from Sacred Range Selected Stories. That's a posthumous collection by Stephen Hyten. This 90-minute conversation and reading will run uninterrupted into and over halfway, obviously, through the second hour of the show. In the bit of time that remains at that point, you'll hear me share a bit of information about quickly approaching deadlines of calls for submissions or upcoming events. Here and maybe a little bit of other information. There will be a song to take us out at the very end as well. My usual start of the hour announcement is that occasionally some poetry, spoken word, or music played on this show may contain strong language, but all is played in its entirety with content unedited to honor the creative integrity of both the author and the piece. And a second announcement, because I won't have the chance, usually at the end of each hour, I say a few words about how these shows are saved. I won't be able to do that the first hour, so I'm doing it now because of that. But just to let you know that it's just a reminder that every week I upload both hours of this show to my personal blog space for it at Finding a Voice on cfrcfm.wordpress.com. They do remain there for 3 years. And normally I get that uploaded, but I'm telling you today that I'm going straight from here to another book launch event this evening. So it will probably be much closer to 9:30, maybe even 10 o'clock before I get them these 2 hours uploaded today. So my apologies for the wait, but if I don't have any glitches, at least by tomorrow morning for sure, or if you're a late night person, you'll be able to hear it much later this evening or then at any point tomorrow morning. And again, up to 3 years, so you've got some time. So I'll tell you what, here we go. I'm also going to read, I'm going to reintroduce it just in case somebody happened to tune in a couple of minutes late and didn't hear what's going on in this first part of the second hour. I'll do that. And I'm also going to read the short blurb from their program, Kingston Writers Fest, a program guide that gives an idea of a short blurb about what you're going to hear. So anyway, in the first and second, well into the second hour today, you're going to hear from a September 19th, 2025, Kingston Writers Fest event called Bushwhacked by Inspiration Short Stories. You're going to hear a conversation between moderator Ser Chiang and authors Catherine Bush, Deepak Rajagopalan, and Jamal Saeed, that, and it will also include a reading by Sarah Chiang from Sacred Rage, Selected Stories. It's a posthumous collection that was written by Stephen Hyten. This 90-minute conversation, again, and reading will run through, obviously, half of the second hour. And at that point, I'll share some other things so that are current. To lead it off, let's go ahead. Here is the short synopsis, I guess, of what from Kingston Writers Fest program guide for last year or last September. And it goes like this. It says, this is all quote, "A short story," wrote Lori Moore, "is a love affair. A novel is a marriage." And that was their quote. And so then it goes on, and I am now quoting the piece. "Indeed, short stories are intense, compressed nuggets of revelation, but the best of them are never fleeting. Their impact can last a lifetime. In Skin, Catherine Bush is haunted by global crises and the complexities of human connection. Deepa mines the quotidian for the universal. Jamal Saeed's stories, written while a political prisoner searched for truth in the imaginary." And again, Sarah Chiang reads from Sacred Rage, Selected Stories, a posthumous collection by Stephen Hyten, who said, "I simply wrote stories whenever I got bushwhacked by inspiration." So here is Bushwhacked by Inspiration, again, from the Kingston Writers Fest. Let's just jump right into it.
"To the 17th annual edition of the Kingston Writers Fest. Isn't it great to be back? My name is Wayne Grady, and as a friend of the Kingston Writers Fest, in fact, as a lover of the Kingston Writers Fest, I am very pleased to introduce event number 5, Bushwhacked by Imagination. We honor the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples who lived here before us and still call it home, and are grateful for the opportunity to share this space that is so rich in history, language, and storytelling. In a moment, I will introduce our moderator for tonight's event, but first, a few words about the event itself. It will last for approximately an hour and a half, and that includes a short question and answer period at the end with questions coming from you. Please raise your hand and shout out your question, and the moderator will repeat the question. We don't have a roving microphone in the audience, so ask your question and the moderator will, who is yet to be named, but I will name you in a minute, will repeat your question before it is answered. I draw your attention to the empty chair, the Penn Canada empty chair in the corner. Penn Canada is the organization that works to free imprisoned and endangered writers around the world who are oppressed because of the work that they've done. This year, the Penn person who is not sitting in that chair is Ala Abdel Fattah, who is one of Egypt's most well-known prisoners, and the author of a book, You Have Not Been Defeated. He's an essayist and a political prisoner of conscience since 2021 for spreading, quote, false news and undermining national security, which sounds ominously familiar. Through this empty chair, we ensure his name is not buried under bureaucracy and fear. And the Council for the Arts, as well as the many institutions, business, and individuals who support the festival, and the dedicated volunteers. Big hand for the dedicated volunteers. who worked for so long and so long hours for the love of books. We thank them all. And now for the usual housekeeping details. Please set your cell phones to stun. When I said that a while ago, it was cool. Now it just makes me sound old. Please mute any devices that might ring or beep and refrain from taking pictures or recording this event. We have a festival photographer whose photographs are posted daily on the Kingston Writers Fest. We don't. Website. And now it is my pleasure. Oh, your phone. Airplane mode. It is now my pleasure to introduce this evening's moderator, Sarah Chang. Sarah is a poet, a children's writer, and all-around generalist when it comes to writing. Her books for children run the gamut from board books such as Toesy Toes, The Stone Hatchlings, and Dogs Don't Eat Jam, to the YA novel Breathing Fire. Sarah's poetry exhibits a similar sense of play with titles such as Sweet Devilry, winner of the Gerald Lampert Prize, status update. Sweet Devilry is the winner of the Gerald Lampert Prize. Status update was a finalist for the Pat Lowther Prize. Desperately Seeking Susans was a great idea. She asked every poet in Canada whose first name was Susan, and even some who weren't. I think someone changed her name to Susan in order to be in this anthology, and created the anthology Desperately Seeking Susans. By writers named Susan, and her most recent collection is Grappling Hook. One interviewer describes Sarah's particular brand of whimsy as solidly rooted in imagination, which sounds like an oxymoron. To which she replied, "I believe that imagination is a kind of solid reality, though it plays out in each individual's head rather than in everyone's head. Fiction itself is a kind of solid imagination, a shared experience." Speaking of shared experience, please join me in welcoming Sarah Chang.
Thank you, Wayne. I appreciate that. Okay, we have an absolutely amazing panel today, though I do feel like a little bit bad for everyone here because all of these books, I have to warn you, are page turners. So when I bump into you on the street in like 2 weeks, you're going to have like all that sleep deprived face because you're going to be plowing through these books, or I might be speaking from personal experience because I could not put them down. Today we're going to listen to the authors read excerpts from their books as I introduce each one of them, and then we'll dive into a conversation about craft. Lastly, there'll be 15 minutes, as Wayne said, set aside for the question period, so do keep those questions top of mind. We have with us today Deepa Rajagopalan, whose first book, Peacocks of Instagram, was a Giller finalist and named an Apple Books Best Book of the Year. Imagine coming out of the gate like that. It's absolutely incredible. Though it was her first book, Deepa is not without significant experience. She's earned an MFA in Guelph's Creative Writing Program, and her stories have appeared in some of Canada's best literary magazines, including Room, the Malahat Review, the New Quarterly, and also in the 2023 Bristol Short Story Prize Anthology. Not only that, but in 2021, Deepa won the RBC Pen Canada New Voices Award for the title story in this collection. Peacocks of Instagram was a book that had me both laughing and crying. It paints characters that are so vivid, they stay with you long after you put the book down. Please help me welcome Deepa as she reads from her brilliant collection, Peacocks of Instagram.
Thank you, Sarah, for that lovely introduction. I'm going to read from a few pages from the beginning of the last story. It's called Bestsellers. Bestsellers. The ceramics, pots, mugs, figurines are nothing to be proud of. If someone had told me all those years ago when my future was bright and everything good was still ahead of me, when the dean of the college told me I was among the cream of the crop and destined to make a difference in the world, that I would be selling ceramics for a living, I would have been terribly offended. I never had any creative inclination, so it was as much a surprise to me as it was to the people who knew me. I sell them on Instagram with pictures I snap on my phone, and with every piece I tell a story from my life. My bestseller for 6 months straight has been a handmade ceramic figurine of a pouting woman holding out a phone. The description under the image reads, "Ceramics by Niloufer. Honey, it's for you. I moved to this country for my husband, abandoning my medical school education back home in India. For me to find a job as a doctor here would have required years of training and money we didn't have. So I worked as the receptionist at a dentist's office. He, however, got promoted every 2 years at a sales job. He could be very charming when he wanted to. In the 10 years we were married, I fiercely stayed the same, and he became unrecognizable. When we were first together, he used to say that couples who used terms of endearment for each other were phonies. Now he's gone and found himself a woman who picks up the phone when I call and says, 'Honey, it's for you.' I designed this piece in her honor. Who wants one? To order, go to my website." The word "designed" is a stretch. The phone is disproportionate, the figurine's face is smudgy, and her eyes remain unrealistically shut because I don't know how to make eyeballs. I can never make two pieces look the same, but that is part of their one-of-a-kind charm. And for the price of a figurine, my customers also get a story. It's the story that moves people. I have found that people would gladly spend money simply to feel something. This type of blatant pity party goes against everything I stood for. My parents raised me and my four sisters to tuck away our problems into secret compartments, never to be opened. The hardest part was leaving the home I shared with my husband. It had a red door, beautiful vaulted ceilings, and shiny hardwood floors that I polished for years. It was difficult for me to accept that I would lose this home, as if it weren't just a home, but a proxy for what our marriage could have been. I moved into a boxy basement apartment within walking distance of the dental office. In the winter, snow accumulated in the window wells and blocked the two small windows. This house was at least 100 years old, and the basement smelled like days-old broccoli soup left inside a smoker's car. The washroom was so small that if I didn't close the standing shower door, I couldn't close the bathroom door. I told no one about the move except my parents back in Hyderabad. It seemed like I had stepped on a long, rickety bridge, and I had no idea where it would take me. I thought my parents would be on the next flight to Toronto, but they told me that I was being selfish and foolish, the two inexcusable sins in our family. They found my situation too shameful to share with people. I didn't blame them. They were the ones surrounded by all of our relatives, forced to go to all the family events, but I could hide here in the basement. The laundry room was on the landing between the basement and the first floor where the landlady lived. On sunny days when she did her laundry, I would return from my morning walk and the snow would glisten like diamonds and pillows of steam would rise from the vent like baby ghosts. The landlady was a single mom with two little children. She had a finance job, the kind my parents would have approved of. But all I heard her do was plead with her kids and cry herself to sleep. The kids threw tantrums regularly, banging doors shut or throwing themselves on the floor and screaming. And she would say things like, "Sweetie, please don't do that," or, "Honey, do you want to sit in the corner and think about your choices?" If I had behaved that way when I was a kid, my mother would have whacked my face. My landlady had the kids with her all the time, except on alternate weekends, so I doubted that she got any time to herself. I felt grateful I never had kids, though I wanted them so badly once. Another bestseller in my store is a hand-molded figurine of twin babies sleeping on a blanket. Their heads are big and their hands and legs are splayed out like startled clowns. The description under the picture reads, "Ceramics by Niloufer. We're having twins." For as long as I can remember, I wanted to have kids. I'm one of five girls, and I wanted to have five girls of my own. Before I married my husband, he wanted to have kids too. But whenever I broached the topic, he said he wasn't ready. 10 years went by, and I was in my mid-30s when my husband asked for a divorce. A year later, I saw a photo of him on Facebook, his arms wrapped around his new wife, his chin resting in her ash blonde hair. "We're having twins," the caption read. I designed this piece the day I saw that Facebook post. My ceramics are my babies now, and I love them a lot. Do you love them too? To order, go to my website. The story of how I came to create these things seemed worth telling. During the divorce proceedings, watching pottery videos on Instagram became a daily distraction, like smoking or stress eating, an escape from the unbearable present moment. Time-lapse reels of talented hands throwing stiff balls of clay onto the potter's wheel, pulling and shaping them into mugs, bowls, vases, or anything those hands desired, offered hope that someday I might be able to control my life in the same way. Every time I got an email from my ex's lawyer, my entire body would go into shock. His lawyer was a female version of him. She had the same eyes, distant, cold, and piercing. She wasn't supposed to copy me on her emails to my lawyer. She did it as an intimidation tactic. As I read and reread the caustic legalese, I would feel out of breath and my chest hurt like I was about to die. But it happened so many times that I realized I wasn't going to die, and somehow that seemed even worse. Then I would have to drink a glass of water and take deep breaths. The rest of the day would be a wash. I'd lie in bed scrolling through pottery videos. I would like and comment on every video I watched and comment, "I did not see that coming. You outdid yourself here," or "Where can I buy one?" In those days, so much of my time went into watching pottery reels that I started to dream I was spinning on a massive potter's wheel inside large blobs of clay, my body stretching and submitting to the wheel. Thank you.
Novelist whose work has been critically acclaimed, published internationally, and shortlisted for too many awards to name here. She is an associate professor of creative writing at the University of Guelph, and she lives in Toronto and part-time in an old stone pre-Confederation schoolhouse in eastern Ontario, complete with slate chalkboards, and she does still use them, I asked. When asked in an interview what inspired her to start writing, Bush replied, quote, "I started writing because I needed to find a way to give words to things that hadn't been given words. Family stories, and sometimes not even stories, but the complex web of emotions that being in a family, any family, arouses. Fear, loss, wonder." Catherine's book, Skin, does exactly what she was setting out to do. She has captured the complexity of humanity and our relations with one another. The stories are far-ranging and vary wildly in length, but each of the stories immerses the reader completely in worlds as tender and heartbreaking as our own. Come on up, Catherine.
The introduction. It's wonderful to be here in Kingston, and it's wonderful to have the Kingston Writers Fest back again. That in itself is thrilling, so hooray! And yeah, Skin, my first collection of stories after five novels, I describe as a book of unusual intimacies, which doesn't necessarily mean kinky, but just unexpected. They're just unexpected. I'm interested in the places where people can touch and not touch others, both literally and metaphorically. And as Sarah said, the stories vary really widely in length. There's a novella. The collection opens with a novella-like novella. And some of the stories are very short, flash fiction, and some are story length. So I'm going to read the title story, Skin, which does involve families. And it's one of the flash pieces, so you get to hear the whole thing. After her divorce, my mother flew to Tanzania. The particular kind of evangelical Christianity that she embraced used foot washing as a form of baptism. And she crisscrossed the country, washing the feet of men and women and children. Many surprised, but most eventually willing to be taken up by the ministrations of this tall, devoted woman. 6 months later, she returned to Toronto and left the church that she'd so recently joined. Yet her impulse to wash others' feet didn't waver. She approached an organization that assisted newly arriving refugees and asked if she could offer her services to those who came through its doors. Of course, not all those seeking the organization's help wanted to have their feet washed. Yet there were some who allowed themselves to be led to the plastic chair that my mother set up in the corner of an office. She spread a towel on the floor in front of Ibrahim from Idlib. Gently, she peeled off his socks, which were as new as the winter boots sitting beside him, and invited him to lower his feet into a basin of steamy water. Lifting his right foot into her lap, she began to soak the cracked skin, working her fingers into the webbing between big toe and second toe and third, tugging on each toe as she went. He faced her with a look of frozen uncertainty. Each day of the last week had been a besiegement of the unknown. The woman holding his foot took out a file and began to rub at the hard calluses of his heels. She pressed a finger to a place on the ball of his foot that sent a jet of feeling through him, so powerful it made him cry out. Then, some part of him, braced for years through the bombings, shellings, since the first time he'd huddled as a child in terror under the kitchen table, experienced a small release. My mother massaged each of his feet in turn with almond oil until his skin was silky, drew his socks over them, and sent him back to the world, wiping tears from his eyes, his gait at least briefly different. When friends asked us how our mother was doing, we tended to be vague, embarrassed by her strange preoccupation. Yet my mother insisted that everyone who arrives in a new country deserves to be touched, and where better than the feet, that vulnerable, overlooked, nerve-rich part of the body? When we were children, she never kissed us as she put us to bed. She unkinked our toes. If something happened during the day to upset us, some unhappy schoolyard incident, she had the ability to find the place on the sole of the foot that called up the moment, a pain that with the pressure of her fingers seeped away. She deduced our moods from the pattern of our wet footprints across a tiled floor after a shower. Later, when I was about to become a mother myself, she told me that her own feet were the most sensitive part of her body. With every step she took, a sensorium burst to life, shooting up through her soles. The grass that she crushed underfoot thrust itself against her. The experience was so overwhelming that she did everything she could to dull it, wore shoes with the thickest tread she could find, scrubbed the soles of her feet with sandpaper, never went barefoot. To my surprise, she confided that her feet were the most eroticized part of her body. She couldn't come to orgasm without a gentle, continuous brushing of her left metatarsal arch. My father, it seemed, had grown tired of her peculiarities. On his deathbed, my father called for my mother. Barely conscious, he kept repeating her name. When at last she appeared, she pulled a chair up to the end of his bed. She unfolded the sheet at the bottom of the mattress and laid a hand atop each of his ankles. He made small cries like a wounded creature as her wet sponge touched him, and she pressed her fingers slowly and methodically to his wasted flesh. Thank you.
Thank you, Catherine. That was incredible. Just, you know, her ability to bring together these intimate moments, and it's so funny and it's so tender at the same time. It's my pleasure now to introduce Jamal Saeed. Jamal arrived as a refugee in Kingston in 2016, escaping from Syria, where he had lived for 55 years. He was a Syrian writer and publisher who pushed against social and political norms, voicing opposition to the regimes of the Al-Assads. He was imprisoned for a total of 12 years, held without formal charge and without judicial process. His first book, My Road from Damascus, a memoir, not only tells the story of Saeed's years in Syria's most notorious military prisons, but also his life during his country's dramatic upheavals. My Road from Damascus was a finalist for the Hillary Weston Writers Trust Prize. Jamal has also co-written a YA novel, Yara's Spring, which was widely celebrated for its poignant writing. Princess Nye and Other Stories is Jamal's second collection of short stories, the first having been published in Syria. Drawing on folk tales, realism, and imagination, Jamal's stories feel true, even when he speaks through magic. There is a deep understanding of humanity in his fiction, and the recognition will often take your breath away as you read this collection. So please come take our breaths away, Jamal.
Good evening, everybody. Thank you so much, Sarah. I'm going to read a story, a part of story, not all of it. It was written in prison about 40 years ago. The title is A Lonely Young Man on a Rocky Shore. He remembered his grandmother's bookmarked face as he walked slowly over the crumbling rocks on the beach. She would have liked to spread her heart out like a warm, tender beach for people to walk on. Does it work?
Okay.
He remembered the day his uncle returned with his family from living abroad. His grandmother went up to his young cousin to hug and kiss him. The little boy took fright and ran away from her, staring with terrified eyes at her bookmarked face and taking refuge in his mother's skirt, shirking. Everyone was embarrassed by the child's behavior, and his grandmother touched the small box scars on her face, her fingers moving quietly, exuding sorrow, trying to put an end to the confusion that filled the room. She looked at the little boy and declared so they could all hear, "You are right, little one. I'm scared of my face too." Then she added softly, "Smallpox is an everlasting curse. Even when I'm dead, you will only remember my bookmarked face. My grandmother's eyes were windows. Every time I looked into them, I could hear her soul weeping. He felt little awkward as he walked over the rocks, as if he was trampling on the bookmarked face of a huge grandmother. He remembered since textbooks, Persian, lime, decay, mineral salts. No, the rocks were much more like his grandmother's face than the textbook description then. He was interrupted by a sea breeze passing gently up his shirt sleeve. oh, this breeze is as soft and delicate as Radha. Suddenly, a long question confronted him with the expression of a stern school teacher. You are walking over the rocks on the beach, not on your grandmother's face. Stop these stupid hieroglyphics. Calling a passing priest Radha and the softness of Radha and I don't know what else. You know, Radha has a snot in her nose like anyone else. Would you marry Radha if she had smallpox? The young man stood before the question like a confused schoolboy, remembering some heartfelt phrases he had once jotted down in his exercise book. Radha is light in a pitch black world, fresh tune when revives the soul, when it is surrounded by desert, a horizon in a world that has lost its horizons. The soul dances around her eyes like butterflies, and only around her eyes can butterflies sing their sweet songs. The question started to make fun of the young man. I didn't ask you to talk about Radha. Would you marry Radha if she had smallpox? It's a simple question, smart ass. And plausibly, the young man protested. This smart ass annoyed him a lot. Love is one thing and marriage is another, he began enthusiastically. Love is a warm light the soul pours over the world. Melodies flow through blood, and the stones dance in time to them. A beautiful madness takes you wandering through the vast space of your soul. Marriage, on the other hand, is a tradition that nobody has ever consulted me about. The question made fun of the confused young man's answer and began spinning a web tied around him, skillful as a spider. Philosophize about love and marriage as much as you like. Do you love Radha? Yes, replied the young man eagerly. Okay. Do you want somebody else to marry her?
No.
We have to live together. I mean, I wish we could. And if she gets a smallpox, the young man shook his head vehemently and ran away from the question. He looked at the sea. A bird folded its wings and swooped down onto the surface of a wave, while another spread its wings and rose up off the same wave. And thank you.
Thank you so much, Jamal. Lastly, I would like to introduce Stephen Hayden, though most of you already know and mourn the loss of this fabulous writer. Stephen passed away in 2022 at the early age of 60. Despite his life being cut short so early, it felt as though Stephen had lived several lifetimes in all that he accomplished. He wrote fiction, poetry, nonfiction, and prodigious amounts, as well as being a singer-songwriter. He was the author of 18 books, including 3 short story collections, 4 novels, and 7 poetry collections. His awards are too long to mention in a brief introduction, but they do include the Governor General's Award and nominations for the Trillium Award, the Journey Prize, and the Pushcart Prize. Stephen was an absolute fixture in Kingston and in my neighborhood specifically. He lived in an area of town informally called Writer's Block. I would often see him either running or walking his dog, and he was incredibly generous with young up-and-coming writers. I remember one time as he jogged by my house, we shared a few words, and as I lamented the fact that my daughter was growing up so quickly, he replied over his shoulder, as he ran, "Children prepare us to die." He was that kind of man, one whose wisdom and poeticism was always flowing, even while exercising. While Stephen can't be here with us today, I'm going to read a short excerpt from his excellent book, Sacred Rage, which was published posthumously this year, and you can get it at the bookstore. So, the part of the story that I'm going to read is from the story, The Dead Are More Visible. And just to give you a little bit of context, in Skeleton Park, which most of you are familiar with, we have this city worker who is trying to flood the ice rink, and there are some tough youths who have come in and started to threaten her, and so she's got the hose, and she ends up whacking one of them in the face with the hose, and his eye pops out. Yeah. Okay. She wasn't sure how soft an eye was. Her impression was that the main material was more or less like pudding, though held firm by a membrane. She could imagine her fingerprint remaining on the eye, a pattern he would look through for the rest of his life. She would wait for the bag of snow and ease it in with a knuckle. A far howl of sirens, the sound slowly mounting. She stayed on her knees, huddled low over the eye as if to shield it from the cold. She cupped it with her shivering hands without making contact. This way, she didn't have to see it. She glanced back. Zach had paused as he reached Shane on his way to the hut. He stood wobbling above his friend. "You're gonna pull through, dude." "The hut," she cried. "I need the bag." "Okay." He staggered on, almost fell again, then his head tilted with a drunk's abrupt, temporary alertness. He'd heard the sirens. They were closing in. He ducked into the hut and emerged briskly, as though instantly sober, and slid towards her across the ice. The whites of his eyes showed larger. She had her left hand out for the bag, and he relayed it to her with his stretched right. For a second, he stood above her, captivated by the eye. He glanced back at Shane. "I gotta get out of here," he whispered loudly, then stepped up on the bank and tore away across the park, the opposite direction from Gabe, his shoulders pitching and his hood peeling back. He ran past the obelisk, the man there turning his head stiffly to watch him go. As the moaning of the sirens merged into a single scream, she stuffed a handful of snow into the bag. They were kept in the hut for picking up dog turds that cluttered the park and sometimes the ice. With the knuckle of her index finger, she nudged the eye over the lip of the bag. It rolled right in. Unsure whether to seal the bag or leave it open, she turned and crawled back towards Shane. She was afraid of standing. She might slip, drop the bag, even fall on it. She crawled on her knees and right hand, her left hand holding the bag clear. Shane sat up as she approached. The back of his hand covering the empty socket was blue and unbloodied. His good eye was fixed on hers. He was seeing her now, really looking. One of those rare times. Sometimes life seemed little else than a struggle to win the attention, the gaze of others. That was what Gavin had really been doing, she supposed, screaming into that van at the end. The ambulance and the two squad cars flashed into sight, driving east on ordnance. They would circle around and enter the park from Bay Street by the hut. They vanished again, but their sirens went on, ripping the air apart. "It's going to be all right, I think," she said, reaching to him. "If I can just keep my eye." "You will." "I'm sorry." "They'll have that base of yours up and running in no time." She wasn't sure if this was true. She'd almost said, "good-looking face." "If I have to go back inside," he said, slurring the words through purple lips, "I can take it, but not blind. Can I see it?" "Guess you'd better confirm we've got the right one," she said. His torso jerked as if shaken by a single laugh. She opened the bag. "Oh, Jesus," he said, stared back at by himself. She set her bare hand on his shoulder. His body trembled under the leather. The folds in the lap of his low-crotched jeans were frozen, so it looked like he had an erection. He didn't flinch or look at her. He wouldn't now. "Did you hurt Walt at the other rink?" "Not like this, hardly at all." "That better be true." She gripped his hood and pulled it roughly onto his head. "And for $20, nobody could believe my life." "With a face like that," she heard herself think. The crass assumption she now sometimes shared that life must be a June breeze for the nice-looking, as if her life had been easy in her teen years. Shane would have been all over her then, and she would have craved him for the danger in his look. Why had nature given bad men all the attractive vitality, like Gavin years ago? Why did horror and romance so often overlap? She pushed her hand further around his shoulder, feeling uncomfortably huge next to him. He seemed about to rest his head against her arm, then he pulled back. A wall of hard, hot light came at them as the ambulance and squad car shrieked up behind. To shield her eyes, she ducked her face, got a closer look at him. He seemed to be going into shock. His good eye stared off to where their twin shadow was fast lengthening over the ice and the shrouded park. The crazy man was lit up at the edge of the headlights' fanning swath. Turned toward them at last, he seemed to be staring, his posture solemn, noncommittal, his baseball cap in his hands like a mourner. "You're gonna be all right," she told Shane, though really, she wanted to take him by the chin and roughly turn his face towards hers and say, "Look at me." One mic to share, so we're just gonna be hopping it around. And all my questions are kind of for all of you. So we're gonna start with an easy one. Or maybe it's hard, I don't know. But my question is why short stories? Because we keep coming back to them as writers. I do always as a reader, but there is so much push to write long fiction, to write screenplays, to write anything that will make you money, right? And short stories are not that. So Catherine has written novels, Jamal has written a memoir and kids' books, Haydn was known best for his novels, and Deepa chose this as her first form. So I'm wondering what brought you all to the short story?
I think short stories come naturally to me. I just love the form, I love how you really need to pay attention to the language, and you have to be as precise as possible. You have to choose the exact word. You don't have room to kind of meander. And I think that's an exercise that I love. I think as a person, too, I'm just like that in and out of it. So it comes naturally to me, but I do also feel like in a short story collection, when you have like 10 to 14 stories, you still need to know everything about your characters, even though you don't put them in the story, even though it's not on the page. For you to build that lived-in quality, you need to kind of know everything about them. You need to know, what kind of childhood they had, even though it's not in the story, or what kind of food do they like, or who are their friends. You kind of know these things, but that gives the story a very lived in and just a richer texture, right? So I really find that very enjoyable, and also the writing process I find very enjoyable. Because you can write a first draft in a few weeks, and then you can spend weeks and weeks editing it, which is my favorite part. But in a novel, you kind of have to take months and months to write the full first draft, and you're kind of always kind of doubting yourself as you're going through that. I really like the short story form. I like to write them. I like to read them.
Yeah. Thanks, Deepa. I wrote short stories when I was a younger writer, and then I began to feel that my natural breath was the longer form of the novel. I wrote a really ungainly story. It was kind of this octopus of a story that I got told wasn't a story, which I found, sort of heart-shattering, because my heart was in the story. But what it really was the seed of my first novel. So I took... my revenge was to take part of that story and make a really well-made short story out of it and get it published and then go on and write my first novel. But I love... It's interesting hearing you talk, Deepa, because I think with the novel still, every word has to count. Like, there's no loose space, and you change a word in the novel, and I'm aware of every time I use that word, and in the novel, there's always a ricochet. But in a story, there there is more left out and there's more compression. And the way you travel through time is different. And you were, I mean, I work on the draft of a novel for a year and a novel for 7 or 8 years. And stories don't take as long to draft, and I return to them over a great long period of time. But there's something about the leap, the compression, the swerve, the pressure of the ending of a story that's just like nothing else. And I returned to stories with intensity during the pandemic because I really wanted to rediscover them. It's like a country I hadn't been to in a long time. And as a way of finding pleasure in a very difficult time when we couldn't touch people at all. So they became very important at that point. And then my editor on this collection, Andrea Alexis, was the one who said, we should make this into a collection. And I was like, okay. And we did.
Thank you, Catherine. When I was a child, actually many times, my dad want to tell me some story about what's happened, and I asked him, stop please, let my mom tell me the story. Why? Because she tells a story in amazing way. It was charming. And in a few words, she could create a world. Later, when I was in prison, I spent about 2 years in a civil prison. And then they stopped judging and sent me to the military prison. In the civil prison, I could smuggle out a short story, not a novel. And actually, the first thing I had published in a fake name was a short story. I published it in Lebanon when I was in Syria. My friend took it to Lebanon and published it. The second thing, and the most important thing actually, when I read Anton Chekhov and Zakaria Tamir from Syria, I felt that this is magic. How to make this world of art, of imagination, of character, how to make me feel the character in a few pages. And then I tried many, many times. In prison, I had enough time to try everything. So I tried to write short stories and show it to the prisoners. They pushed me to write more short stories. Yeah. Thank you.
That is the first time I've heard write short stories because they're easier to smuggle out of prison. That is a really, I feel like we should be doing this talk in a high school. That is a great observation. You know, all of you kind of touched on this, that in short stories there's something that is left out, but the author knows it all, right? Like you were saying, like you have to know everything about the story. And Catherine, like what you said about endings, to me, that is the essence of a short story. It's always the end, because in a novel, it's like you're given everything. You're given the denouement, you're given everything, right? And in the short story, I think part of the magic is that it's like somebody rings a bell and you just hear the reverberations, like on and on and on, right? A short story kind of rings inside of you for such a long time. And I noticed that with all of your stories, like there would be, I would just think about them over and over again through the days, right? And the characters would stay with me. And I do think that this compression, this like taking away of things, creates readers who want to explore it more, right? In those times after. So thank you, I just thought that was really interesting. So many of these story collections feel linked either thematically or through characters in the stories. And I was just wondering for all of you if the stories are linked at all in your minds, or if they're totally different.
I think in my collection, I think I did that very intentionally. They're linked by mostly by characters, but some of them by place as well. It was interesting because when I was writing the collection, I found that happening kind of naturally. And then I removed them because this is a short story collection. So I removed them. And then as I was editing it, I just realized that I missed that. I felt like, okay, it's a short story collection, but I still want those very subtle links. And I put them back in, and my editor said it's too subtle. She's like, five readers at the beginning. And I'm like, yeah, but, I want that to be, for those readers who are paying attention. And she's like, I think you should make it more prominent. So I did go back and spent, a couple months doing that. And it was so satisfying because I was able to really zone into perspective when I was doing that. So in a story, you see a character from their point of view, their perspective, like in the first person, and then you encounter them from a different person's point of view, and you see this completely different, a positive, almost a noble side to them that you didn't see in their own story. And I just thought that was such an interesting thing to explore. And also, leave little Easter eggs of things that in that story, it's just a little passing comment, but in another story, you just remember it, and I'm like, it's so satisfying. I find it satisfying as a reader, and I really wanted to put that in intentionally.
It was so satisfying, and every time I was like, ooh! Every time I recognize
the character
again, so thank you for doing that.
The stories in Skin, some of them are older and were written quite early in my career. And there's a couple that I did Voices Over Water, which actually draws on some of my own family history. I didn't change very much. And another one called the International Headache Conference, which is about the weird intensity of having a migraine, but it's all... I wish there were a real International Headache Conference, because I would go. So I had to make one up. And then I also returned to a couple of older ideas in the opening novella, which is set in New York in the 1980s, but told retrospectively from the present, and another story called Camouflage, which I'd started very early and never finished. And so it was really interesting to return to that material in recent years and completely transform it, but there was still a kernel of something, like this pulse that was still alive and that I needed to make live again. And then as Andre, my editor, and I were trying to figure out how to order the collection, then we could see that there is fear and grief and loss, but there is also this yearning and desire and skin and the desire to touch others and figure out how can we be close even under really unusual circumstances. And so that became a through line. And then we had to figure out how to arrange the longer and the shorter works together. And I feel very satisfied because I feel that there's a journey through the collection, through time, but also through the kinds of relationships, from relationships between humans to between humans and the more than human world in a time of climate catastrophe in some instances. And readers have responded strongly to this feeling there's a sense of journey. And for me, it's also, it's in a way the most autobiographical book I've ever written, I think. And so it feels really deeply personal, even though it's really refracted. And so that's another unifying element, I would say.
Yeah, I feel that journey.
Yeah. Great. Thank you, Kathy. Well, actually, I lived in an environment where the stories are on the streets. Everywhere you can find a story. And actually, they are something magic, something like the people need to imagine. We, in that environment, we didn't need to imagine so much. Even so, I had imagined a lot of things. And actually, I lived with the